Welcome back to Table 40. I'm Matt Holliday. I'm here with my wife, Leslie, and we are happy to be joined by the head basketball coach at Oklahoma State, Coach Mike Boynton. Coach Boynton is, what year is this, Coach?
This will be my fourth year upcoming coach. As the head coach, yeah, my fifth year in Stillwater.
But Coach has done a great job with our basketball program, and we are thrilled to have you, and thanks for coming on and joining us, and like I said, we're excited to have you.
I appreciate the invite. I'm a big baseball fan, so I've watched you play, and I've admired that, and obviously coming here, I didn't know much about Oklahoma State baseball, to be perfectly honest. But the year I got here as an assistant coach was 2016, and they went to the College World Series, beating my alma mater, which I was not all that thrilled about. I just got here. I wasn't, like, ingrained in the culture yet. So, but then they beat Clemson, too.
They ran through the state.
So I was all jacked about them beating Clemson.
They ran through the state that year. I was still playing, and I remember thinking that was a tough road, man, to go through – South Carolina and Clemson to get to the World Series. They were both teams were really good that year, but that was a really good year for us.
And I'm a Yankee fan, so I think my first year here, you actually signed with the Yankees. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 1 year
with the Yankees. Josh and I obviously got to know him when I became the head coach a little bit better. We talked about it all the time. We never made it up for a game, but that's pretty cool.
I wish you would have given you the tour.
Well, I've been there, obviously. I grew up in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I would have taken you in the clubhouse. Yeah. I'd have given you the VIP.
Yeah, I never got that one. Never got that one.
Get you some swings on the field.
All right, so you grew up in Brooklyn, and then how did you get all the way to Oklahoma? Because that's a little bit different from Brooklyn Stillwater, Oklahoma.
You may need a whole new podcast for this story.
You can tell the short version.
Yeah, I'm trying to give you the nickel version.
That's a big difference.
So obviously I played basketball growing up. I played it all my life from the time I think I was like 4 years old. And, I got good enough to get a scholarship to college. I went to the University of South Carolina in Columbia and had a great experience there. When I went into college, I was pretty confident that I would leave college and be a professional basketball player for the rest of my life. Because that's what we all think, right? But I don't know. At some point, I realized that, maybe that's not the path. And maybe I'll go overseas for a couple of years and then do something else. And a strange thing happened. After my senior year, I was training to go to Belgium. I had a contract offer in Belgium to go play in Europe. And I suffered my first injury ever. I'd never been injured. So I started at 4. I'm 22 now. And I think that was the first time the Lord had spoke to me professionally, like basketball playing for you is over. I know that wasn't the way you thought about it, but I'm just kind of intervening here, if you don't mind.
Exactly.
And so I got into coaching right immediately. I was a grad assistant at Furman University. Then I spent 2 years at Coastal Carolina, who won a college baseball national championship 1 year. And I spent a year at Wofford College. And then I was back in my alma mater as an assistant coach, spent 5 years there and then went to Stephen F. Austin, spent 3 years there. And the guy I was working for, Brad Underwood, who's the head coach of Illinois now, got the head coaching job here at Oklahoma State. And so that's ultimately how I wound up here. Ironically, I interviewed for the head coaching job at Stephen F. Austin when Brad took the job here. And I didn't get it. I was maybe the most frustrated and disappointed professionally that I had ever been, because I thought, I'd worked so long to kind of climb this ladder and thought this was my opportunity. In fact, I tell people all the time, I believe I'm a believer. But I think sometimes we kind of think we're telling us, Lord, what we want. I think I was prayed more those 3 weeks during that interview process than I had ever prayed in my life. And it wasn't kind of a, like, forgive me, I'm a sinner. It was, hey,
this job.
Now, let's go.
Good time.
Yeah, let's do this. I'm ready. And
it should work for me. It should work for you.
Yeah. Right. Didn't work out. So I came here. And so Brad was here for a year. I was an assistant. And he left to go to Illinois. And it was almost a year to the day that I was – told I wouldn't become the head coach at Stephen F. Austin, that I was actually announced as the head coach here. And, you know, again, my faith doesn't allow me to brush that aside. There was a purpose in me not getting the Stephen F. Austin job. In fact, I do believe now the Lord was kind of whispering to me like, no, not yet. And I was like, yeah, right now. and so that's kind of the story. That was my journey.
That's awesome. We're so glad you're here. We've had the privilege of having one of your players in our Bible study, and man, we love him so much. He's awesome, and he has awesome things to say about you. We've asked him behind your back. We're like, what's he really like? He's like, he's the best. So
I try as often as I can. I certainly don't get it right all the time, but just being genuine has really served me well. I'll say that it's really helped. Because things go awry all the time, but when people know that you're being real with them, that you're being honest, you're giving your best effort to look out for them, and usually they can rally behind you.
Who would you say has had the biggest impact on you from a manhood standpoint, and then maybe from a coaching standpoint, and maybe even with your walk with the Lord? Like, who are some of the people that have had a big impact on your life?
Yeah, so all those would be probably different people. I'll start with my manhood. My dad, I was really fortunate. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I got four sisters and no brothers. And so my dad and I were really close, and he really taught me what it meant to be a responsible father. And so I always credit him for some of the lessons that I learned growing up. I credit my sisters too, because they taught me in some ways how to stay out of a woman's way. So it's helped me in my marriage now. But truthfully, I grew up around probably only one other guy of probably eight or nine guys that I grew up with that actually had their dad in their life. And I could see a significant difference in how we view things. So my dad's been really, really influential in, you know, the way I believe you treat a woman, as he treated my mom, and the way you raise your daughters, as I'm having the opportunity to do now, that you show up and you give your best effort and work as hard as you can. And some days you don't get all the way to the finish line, but the next day you do the same thing and you try to get a little bit closer. So he's been the biggest influence on that side. From a coaching standpoint, there's been so many people, you know, as you go through this, and I told you my journey on all those stops, I worked for different people. And so it gave me a kind of versatile perspective on how to have success or how I didn't want to do things when I had an opportunity to become a head coach. But the guys, I think it started when I was really young. My high school coaches and my AAU coaches, still really good mentors to me today. I played for two really good guys in college. Eddie Fogler recruited me. He was an assistant coach at North Carolina under Coach Dean Smith. And then he retired after my freshman year at South Carolina, and I played for a guy named Dave Odom, who actually coached at Wake Forest and had Tim Duncan and all those guys. So I was really fortunate to play for two really good coaches in college, and those guys are both really strong influences in my life. It's hard to pinpoint one. I would say all of them have had pretty good influence, and they're all guys that I really still lean on to today. As far as my spirituality, I just can't help but be honest in this regard. I really wasn't into it as a young person. My grandmother, my dad's mom, would make me go to church with her when I would stay at her house on the weekend. So I never wanted to go to grandma's house. I didn't enjoy, because I didn't understand the value of the experience. In fact, I remember vividly falling asleep a couple of times in church. I probably wasn't the only kid, but I remember being woken up with my grandmother. It wasn't just a nudge, I'm telling you. It was kind of a wake up and pay attention. But I think as I got older, you know, things kind of began to gain a little bit more perspective. My best friend to this day is a guy who was a pastor in Columbia, South Carolina. So when I went to college, I kind of got away from home and kind of saw things differently. And I just kind of latched on to this guy, and he was a great influence on me. He married Jenny and I, and we've just really been blessed by his presence in our life. And I just have been able to hold on to it, fortunately. Even through some tough times, when Jenny was pregnant with Ace, our oldest son, I lost my job right around the same time. So she was pregnant and I lost my job like in a matter of months. And that really kind of, it allows you to kind of make a decision. Is it woe is me or there is a plan, right? And I always believe there was a plan. Everything happened for a reason. And so I think my grandmother laid a foundation in me, and he kind of watered that seed a little bit as I got older, because I wasn't ready for it when my grandmother was trying to give it to me at 8 or 9. I just didn't want to hear it. But as I got older and kind of was able to understand a little bit more of how important that part of your life is, having somebody there to nurture that and continue to pour into it really helped.
That's awesome. I was also, Matt, we talked about this a little bit before we hit record, but I would love for you to coach us on, man, what's going on right now in the world and in a lot of the racial tension and just honestly, just a tragedy that we see in the news. And I would just love your wisdom on what's the best thing to do? For Matt and I raising kids, like tell us what the best thing to do as parents are to teach our kids well. So we can stop this pattern or prayerfully stop this pattern of quite frankly, just abuse that's going on.
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert, right? I'm just going to kind of maybe try to share my perspective a little bit. When I went to college, I actually didn't know what I wanted to major in. I thought it was kind of an overrated concept anyway, going in. I don't know why. I just had that intuition because I knew so many people who were doing things that had nothing to do with what they kind of got a degree in, right? So early on, I think I understood that unless you want to be a doctor, right, you need to learn medicine, you go to college to learn about yourself. And so that's the way I approached my major. I actually majored in African-American studies. And so all of my classes kind of gave me at least a view on how the history of all this started. And so that's kind of where I'm going to speak from and maybe catch up to, you know, sometimes believe if you don't learn from mistakes, you repeat them, right? We tell our guys that, right? You know, sure. You got to learn so you can grow. And it's not comfortable. The one thing I'll say about this, I'm not sure how complicated it is. I think it's actually pretty simple, but it's not easy, mm-hmm. right? So it's not a complex issue. It's just an uncomfortable one because we're so used to things being a certain way and it's hard to change. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to change because sometimes change means we have to distance ourselves from people we might like, but we don't agree with. And if they don't want to change, then we have to make a decision. But so this the history of this kind of behavior goes back a long time. Obviously the country, and not just this country, there was slavery everywhere in the world. But the way it happened here was so unique to the African-American demographic that it almost scarred them for almost, you know, we're 400 years now removed from that. And I think one of the things that that always, I think, makes people uncomfortable is admitting that that's a fact. All right. Because we say it's not like it now. Well, it's not as bad as it was. No question. No, I don't know if anyone would argue that it's like it was. The four of us can go into a restaurant and eat together. Right. We're not in segregation. But there's still, because of the system being that way for so long, there are established norms and acceptances that people who benefited from that just aren't willing to give up. And so we have to start with the acknowledgement of the problem. And then we can get to the conversation of, well, how do we change the mindset of those people? And that's where I don't know, because that's where it's in your heart. Yeah. And you're taught that. You've had children. They weren't born looking at things a certain way. You could watch two babies literally go to a park and they just see other babies. Like, there's no skin color. There's really no gender. I sometimes have to tell my son, hey, that's a little girl over there. You can't be that rough, or don't touch them. They, you know, they don't think that way.
Right.
Those are things that are taught. And so we got to stop teaching our kids that we should view people differently, and just accept that it's okay to look different. That's kind of what makes our nation unique, is that we all should have opportunities regardless of where we come from and our backgrounds. And I think what you're seeing now is, and I actually believe that this is a positive, to be perfectly honest. It's really doesn't look good. I'll start there. It's not a good look. But I think what George Floyd's case in particular has allowed people to do is, that one was so bad. A lot of the other cases, there's been a segment of people who tried to say, well, if they hadn't done this, then maybe.
Try to justify it, yeah.
Right. This one was so egregious.
There's nothing.
It went so far. Like, everyone almost unanimously is like, yeah, can't.
That was awful.
Yeah. Even people who may have wanted to find a way, you know, to justify it have been like, this is not one I can really die on. And so what I think it's done is it's given us an opportunity, right, for people of all races to say, if this is systematic, if people are being trained to deal with people this way, that's a problem. And now how do we advance the conversation to either this, the training has to be better. We have to be willing to accept that people don't speak the same all the time. And that's okay. Our differences is what makes us great. It's what challenges us to be better. And so I think this case is going to, I think this one will be different. I really believe that in my heart. Because of the universal acceptance, almost, is that I think people are truly willing to say, now's the time. We've accepted this too long. The list is getting longer by the year, and almost embarrassingly so to our country, that we haven't figured out a better way to deal with, well, this police brutality. And again, it's not all police. Leon Jones, who's the chief of police on our campus, is a great friend. I respect him and the officers on campus. But there are some people out there who won't allow themselves to accept that. I think the other part of it is people who are not, who aren't Black, right? They have to listen more. And I don't know what the answer is to changing it, but I do think it starts with having an honest conversation, an uncomfortable conversation of, here's what the reality is. And I'll give you my own personal experience with police officers. When I was 12 years old, this really happened. I was riding a bike in Brooklyn, New York, like I did probably, I don't know, 5 days a week. And I hear a police siren in behind me, which wasn't unusual at all. It's kind of like
birds in Oklahoma.
Yeah, yeah. Right, absolutely. Absolutely. Or cows eating grass, whatever yeah. it is. Yeah. But for some reason, as I drove for about a minute, I hear the siren getting eerily louder. And like, it's getting closer to me. And long story short, a cop car jumped the curb and pulled off onto the sidewalk while I was riding my bike, almost to where it made contact with me. Because I look over my shoulder, I see it, and I kind of jump off the bike, and they were coming for me. I mean, they were, I don't know if they thought, they weren't necessarily coming for me. They were coming for somebody, and that somebody they thought was me. So I jump off the bike. I kind of put my hands up like, what is going on? I never saw this before, but three officers get out of the car. I never saw three officers in the car before.
Yeah, I didn't see that either.
All of them with their guns drawn. And I'm 12 now, and I may look like I'm 14 or 15. I was tall, you know. I may have started growing facial hair, but I certainly didn't. I don't think I looked like I was
an adult.
Intimidating. I don't mean. So they one guy kind of roughs me up, puts me up against the wall, spreads me, pats me down. He starts asking all these questions that I'm so nervous, I can't even think to answer. Where's your ID? What are you doing? Where are you going? Yeah. And they finally sit down, and they sit me on the ground. And while you're out here, and I'm like, just kind of riding the bike. It's nice outside. We don't get to do this very often. Sorry for riding my bike. But one of the other officers, about a minute later, gets a call and says, hey, looks like we're at the wrong place. So let's go. And the one guy who had me kind of hemmed up said, I apologize. You look like someone who fit the description of someone who robbed a store here recently. And even if I had, all right, let's just say I had went to a store somewhere in Brooklyn and stole some potato chips or a can of soda. I mean, do I really need to have three cops pull their guns out on me? And like, but those are real experiences that don't happen as often. And when we can accept that, I think that gives us an opportunity to really advance the conversation. Like, that shouldn't be okay, because maybe somebody did take some potato chips out of the store and make, they should have caught the guy, right? Committed a crime. But even him shouldn't feel like he's going to die for it.
Right.
You know, find a guy, put him in handcuffs, write him a citation, and let's move on. And that's okay. But that's just not where we are, and hasn't been where we've been. And until we can get where the benefit of the doubt is assumed both ways, I think it's maybe the best way to put privilege, because people seem to maybe have a hard time understanding. What do you mean by privilege? I think it's quite simple. You get the benefit of the doubt. If the three of us walk into a store together, if it's a really nice store, let's say it's a high-end shoe store, right? The assumption is you guys are there to shop. I may be there to shop, but maybe not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's just really simple. Like, we need to kind of stop with that thought process. I kind of blabbered on, but I think that maybe trying to paint a picture of that's where the frustration is we're not afforded the benefit of the doubt many times. And that's just kind of a small example, but I think it goes beyond that. Hiring opportunities, you assume that when I was probably 13 or 14, I started hearing people say, man, you speak so well. And at that age, I didn't understand that was kind of offensive.
Right.
Because why wouldn't I?
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like I was reciting Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I mean, I just didn't use slang all the time. I didn't master the English language, but it's okay if I don't, that you and I can have a conversation, you can understand me,
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so there's a lot, but I think listening to each other, truly hearing each other's hearts, and then being more just loving. I mean,
do you think that, I mean, I just like with the training with the police officers, and I mean, do you think it comes down to like just education and training, or, I mean, like, what are some things, what do you think some practical things, like even for us, like, I guess maybe just educating our kids, like you want to do something, right? When you see this kind of injustice, you want to do something to help. And then you just sit back and say, well, what can we do? Where does this start? You know, is it with just raising our kids to see it the right way and things like that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a part of it. I tell my kids all the time, love more, fearless. And I think fear drives a lot of this activity on the police officers' parts. And maybe because they're not trained to defuse situations, or they're not as equipped to maybe defend themselves just if something happened, you know, not talking like a gunfight, I'm talking just a fight, right? And so to gain that power back, you resort to the ultimate in defense. And it starts with not feeling comfortable that you can just handle the situation, you know? And a lot of these, I mean, the guy 4 years ago who was selling cigarettes outside the store, I mean, he's much bigger, but good grief. I mean, let the guy go, you know?
Yeah.
You have a gun. I'm sure he's not going to probably just try to attack you. And I think that's where there has to be more training in the fear part. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know if you can be an effective police officer if you fear going out in a community that you're supposed to protect, you know?
You go anywhere, yeah.
Yeah. You kind of have to, you got to be brave. There's some brevity here. I mean, you got to be willing to, take some risk. I think that's kind of inherent with the job, you know? It kind of be like if a coach didn't want to get on the airplane.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be a tougher task to do.
You got the car a lot.
So you said a couple of things that reminded me of this quote that I heard not that long ago. And it says, when God's nature becomes our practice, we're going to live the life God intended for us to live. And so I think like just the love more and fear less. And some of the things that I keep hearing you say a little bit over our time together is I really love what his name's Mark Moore. I swiped it from him, but I love what this Mark Moore guy says. He's talking about when God's nature, which God's nature is like he, in this lecture that he's talking about teamwork, it's community between the Trinity, like Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He's talking about proximity, that God's available to us. He's vulnerable to us through the life of Jesus. And he's with us from the time we enter this world until the time we leave this world. And the ultimate quality that is so admirable from my perspective in the life of Jesus is his humility. And I think a lot of the things that you're saying remind me of those three things of teamwork. Like we should be able to have honest conversations with our friends and learn from one another, because we haven't experienced this the way you've experienced this. And we can have these theories and we can have these ideas, but we really need to sit with someone and be a team and learn from each other. In the proximity, like we need to be able to enter these spaces with each other and like full of grace and full of humility and full of like just being with each other and being vulnerable and looking ourselves in the mirror and say, okay, this is one area that my past is influencing a little too much, and that needs to leave my home, and that cannot be repeated any longer. And I think just the humility to admit that we have so much to learn and such a long ways to go in these conversations and in these changes. And I know from my perspective, and I would love to hear what you think about this, is like, I think that like the whole racism thing, I don't like that word. And I don't like that. I want to be a home that's like anti, like just like, kids, don't touch the fire. It's going to burn you. Like, I want it to be like that serious in my house, to where, no, there is no room. Like, I'm talking, we're not going to do movies. We're not going to do it. Like this isn't a laughing matter. This is so dangerous to go down a road that would even allude to hurting someone because they don't look like us. And I think that it's just absurd when you say it out loud. You know what I mean? But I think that the line has to be drawn in homes, particularly Christian homes, because we know better because of what the Bible says. Sure. And I don't know. I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, is that taking it extreme?
I totally agree. I think the humility part is a big part of it. And you said it multiple times, but we have to come to grips with, we're all the same.
Yeah.
You know,
we're all adopted into the family. Humility. Right, right.
You guys know my wife isn't black, so we have mixed children, and I worry for them, because which side are they going to be viewed on? Because in many ways, sometimes you feel like you're picking a side, which that shouldn't be the case. And so I totally agree. We have to be able to sit down with people that we love, whether it be our children, our brothers and sisters related, our distant relatives, and say, I'm just not accepting this behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, when I say it's not complex, but it's not easy. Because we all have friends or people that we know or associate with that we hear things, and maybe we don't challenge it. Mm-hmm. I think in order to really be able to kind of advance this is I've got to be willing to check another black man and say, no, you can't say that about him. Mm-hmm. And that I'm not going to accept you being around me thinking those thoughts and treating people that way. And, you know, if you have a real relationship, you'll get through that. And I always tell people, if you can't get through it, then maybe that's not the person you should be in a relationship with. Yeah. Because in order to get everybody to the next level, because I do believe there's some people who aren't going to get on the ship. Got to let them go.
But they've got to be the minority. You know, they've got to be a small part of the community.
Absolutely. And I believe it. I believe generally in the good nature of people. I really do. I believe that there's a majority of people who think, believe in loving everybody and treating everybody the same. But it's kind of like fans of sports. There are more good fans than bad, but the good fans don't speak nearly as much as bad fans.
They just watch the game and leave.
Yeah, they're not as loud.
And they support you.
That'll make the noise.
Yeah, you know, it's the silent.
Yeah.
Right? Majority that we need to rally. And we got to just kind of, it's got to become very lonely for those people who want to be disruptive of the way life is supposed to be lived.
Oh, no doubt. That's so good. That's so good. All right, Mike, I have to ask you a really serious question. So Matt loves basketball, as you know, and he plays all the time. So when walk-on tryouts happened last year, do you think he would have made the team?
No shit.
You know what? I'll be honest. When I never told him this. when we first had walk-on tryouts, I think he had just kind of got back to Stillwater, kind of was moving around and playing a little bit more. I really thought about calling him up and saying, hey, man, I know you didn't, you know, finish. You got some
eligibility left. Yeah. Yes.
So, you know.
I might have made it through two practices before I'd have said, hey, coach, I'm just going to hang out with you. I'm just going to watch.
But, no, I think he could have made it. We had 80-some-odd guys come out there.
I came by the tryout. I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh, my God.
I couldn't believe it either. I mean, you definitely know you could have made it over some of the guys who were trying out.
I could have beat some of those guys.
You know he played intramural this year.
I did.
That hurt.
Yeah, he did.
But some of your guys, I think some of your managers maybe were on the team. Yeah. Or maybe football guys. I don't know.
He loved it.
I had a couple guys, these fraternity guys, you know, they're pretty witty. You know, I was doing really well and we were winning. And he said, geez, of course he's winning. He's got 2 decades of practice on all of us.
That's awesome.
They had some funny old man lines that I had to laugh. So.
Yeah. He loves it. But we're such fans of yours. And of course, your wonderful wife, Jenny, we've had lunch together a couple of times. And she's awesome.
Yeah,
she is. Kids are awesome. My gosh, they're beautiful kids. And Ace is the fastest little child I've ever seen in my entire life. And so he's an athlete now.
That's
But
we appreciate you coming on and taking.
I appreciate you guys having me. I enjoyed it. If you kind of cycle back around and want to get up again after you get through all your rest of your professional athletes, let me know.
We really appreciate it, Mike. Seriously,
I'm like a utility guy, man. I'm ready to come off the bench and do whatever you need. All right,
appreciate it.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike. Tell Jenny. Thank you, guys. Have a good night.